Welcome to A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, a worldwide web event.
Brought to you by Chevy, technologies that go from gas-friendly to gas-free. Sponsored in part by Post-it Flags, find what matters fast. Sponsored in part by Skype, bringing people closer with video calling.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to week number 3 of our New Earth web class. And again, I thank you, Eckhart Tolle, thank you for joining us as we bring students and seekers together to discuss our latest book club selection, Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth. I'm happy once again to see that we've been connecting with readers around the world. We've gotten questions and comments just this week from as far away as Rotterdam, Rio, Beirut, Casablanca, Greece, Seoul, and even Tasmania. Hello, Tasmania. Thank you for all of your really so thoughtful your emails have been. And I can tell you, we love hearing from you wherever you are. There have been either 2 million of you who've watched our classes live or on streams or downloads. No matter how you're watching, I welcome you to the awakening, the shift in consciousness that's happening really all over the planet. So I want to get started on chapter 3. As you see on your screen, you can type in your questions and send them to us instantly throughout the class. We're going to be speaking with students via Skype. You know, Skype is that free software that allows you to make internet and video phone calls from all over the world. Welcome again.
Thank you.
Did you have a good week?
Very good, thanks.
Very good. So if we were to summarize, last week we were talking about how the current state of humanity is that we are humans here living on the planet Earth, have an ego, and learning to manage that ego is what this book is all about.
Yes, and going beyond ego at the same time means going beyond what the Buddha described as the normal human condition, which is one of suffering. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately the ego, sooner or later, and usually sooner, always produces some form of suffering. So it's really transcending the ego, going beyond the ego, at the same time means going beyond this unconscious urge to generate more and more suffering, both in people's personal lives as well as collectively.
We did something last week that was unprecedented. You said this has never been done before on television, where you just sit there in silence. I thought a lot of people responded to the sense of connection from that. So you want to do that again?
Yes.
Let's do that again.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So you're going to lead us in silence.
Okay. I'll just maybe one or two little hints about what to do with your mind when you go into silence, because not speaking isn't complete silence yet, because usually, even though you're not speaking, the mind is still active and producing noise. So how to stop the mind from producing noise, or how to reduce the amount of noise that the mind produces, is quite easy. You take your attention away from the mind, from thinking, and we did that already last week, and simply become aware that you are breathing. The air flows in and out, and you feel yourself breathing. Air flows in and out of the body. And so as we go into silence now for a few seconds, just direct your attention and feel your own breath.
Was nice.
Yes.
Today's lesson, chapter 3, beginning on page 59. I love the idea that we're all literally on the same page. Everybody, page 59, the core of the ego. Most people are so completely identified with a voice in the head, the incessant stream of involuntary and compulsive thinking, and the emotions that accompany it, that we may describe them as being possessed by their mind. My question to you, if we are not that constant stream of thinking, then who are we?
Now, that question usually would be answered by the mind by giving some kind of concept of who we are. Now,
yes, there, I am female.
This, that.
I'm African American. Yes. I work on TV.
Yes.
My mother was, my mother is. Yes. I live at,
that's
my job
right.
is.
Yes.
Yes. That's how most people, if you say, who are you?
Yes. But beyond that, because concepts refer to who we are temporarily in the world of form. You're a mother, you're a father, you have a certain profession, a certain belong to a certain race, you're a man or a woman, nationality, all these things. Now, when you ask, who are we beyond that, there is no conceptual answer to that. That would no conceptual answer would be absolutely correct. We can give little hints. We can say, we are the formless consciousness behind all that. Mm. We are that which cannot be defined through concepts or words. So knowing who you are is not, does not mean that suddenly you have some new idea in your head and say, oh, now let me tell you who I am. I've discovered who I am. Mm-hmm. You get closer to knowing you who you are if you come to a stage where you have that feeling, and I mention it in the book somewhere, when people tell me, I don't know who I am anymore, because they have realized who they are not. Mm-hmm. They are ultimately not their profession. They are not whatever function they fulfill. They are not their nationality. So they now, they're beginning to realize that's not really who I am. But then they enter the unknown and say, well, if I'm not that, now I'm no longer sure who I am. And I always congratulate people when they say, I'm not sure who I am anymore. And I say,
well, that usually connotes confusion.
Confusion, if you still want to know who you are, but if you can become comfortable with not knowing who you are, mm-hmm. with not defining yourself mm-hmm. to yourself or to others, mainly to yourself, because the ego is constantly a self-definition. To remind yourself who you are, you remember your story of your past and mm-hmm. so on. You have opinions about yourself, and so this is the self-definition.
But don't we obviously need the ego, Eckhart? Don't we obviously need it? Otherwise, why would we have it? Why wouldn't we have evolved past it?
We're doing that now. Mm-hmm. So it's been a stage in the evolution of consciousness, a necessary stage in the evolution of consciousness.
For survival.
Yes. Yes.
Because?
The ego arose because we started to think. So the ability in humans, suddenly humans developed the ability to differentiate and to think. To me, the beginning of the Old Testament really describes the beginning of the ability to think, because what it says in the Old Testament is they ate of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, the ability to say this is good, this is bad, to differentiate, starting to think. Mm-hmm. So the ability to think arose in our species, which was a wonderful thing on the one hand, but over many, many millennia, hundreds of thousands of years, more and more, our original sense of connectedness with life and with being, which the natural world still has, animals mm-hmm. still have that. They live in a state of natural
connectedness. Some cultures did.
Some of ancient cultures. That's right.
Yes.
They still have that, a sense of being rooted, being comfortable in your own skin, being rooted deeply within, and feel that sense of oneness with the totality of life, oneness with life itself. Mm-hmm. And so humanity had that once, and as you say, some ancient cultures, perhaps there's still remnants of ancient cultures, and they still have that. Mm-hmm. But humans, as they went into more and more thinking and differentiation, they gradually, their sense of self gradually moved from the center of their being, which I would describe as their heart or the solar mm-hmm. plexus, into their mind.
Into their mind.
And they more and more they began to identify mm-hmm. with the movement of thought. And gradually, out of this continuous identification with the movement of thought, a thought-made entity was produced, which is mm-hmm. the ego.
Yeah, which is what you're saying is being possessed by our mind.
Yes.
Okay. By being possessed by our minds. Okay, you say this is the egoic mind, and we call it egoic because there's a sense of self, of I, in every thought, every memory, every interpretation, opinion, so forth. And this is unconsciousness, spiritually speaking.
Yes, because you identify with thought rather than being, identifying with your inner essence, which is what we lost, which is the state of Eden or paradise, as it's described
in the Bible.
The Bible. We lost that, and it's not only in the Bible. There are many ancient cultures where they speak of the golden age that we lost in many different cultures.
And you say egos are all the same on the surface. They only, they differ only on the surface. Deep down, they're all the same.
Yes.
Okay. Now, chapter 3 is all about the core of the ego, what makes it thrive.
Yes.
And you say that what we react to in another, we strengthen in ourselves. Can you give us an example of that? One of the things the ego needs to survive is reacting against other people. What you react to in another, you strengthen in yourself, you say.
Yes, that's usually what we react to most strongly in others, and what we most strongly condemn in others is usually something that we also have, a trait that we also have, but that we are unconscious of in ourselves. So when we, for example, we become upset if we encounter somebody who is very greedy, or we could become upset about somebody who is dishonest, no matter who, the force of your reaction usually tells you that something in you that you need to look at.
Really? All the time? All the time?
Well, it's for you to find out, or anybody to find out in their own lives. When you react strongly, have it then become alert and have a look inside.
Okay, you say complaining is one of the ego's favorite strategies for strengthening itself. Every complaint is a little story the mind makes up that you completely believe in.
Yes. Now, that's a very common thing, and perhaps until people begin to become more aware.
And some egos survive on complaining.
Some egos who haven't got much else to identify with, they can survive on complaining alone. So then continuously you are condemning other people, you're continuously criticizing, condemning, or judging negatively situations that you're in, your surroundings, other people.
So the ego is the identification with those thoughts. It's not necessarily the thought.
No, it's the thing that you become those thoughts.
Okay.
There's no space between you and the thought.
Got that. Okay. All right. So name calling is also a form that the ego, defines itself.
Yes, and that, of course, one could say, well, it's relatively harmless. On one level, it's relatively harmless to call a person this or that, to attach a label to a person. But if you follow this up to see, you can actually see how dreadful it is to label another human being or a group of human beings. Because once you have labeled, you've attached a mental label to another human being, you have desensitized yourself to the aliveness and the humanity of that other human being, because you're relating now to a label. So if you say he's a, whatever it may be, he's a communist, he's this, he's that, any label, and immediately, instead of sensing the aliveness of that human being and have some empathy with that, you have cut yourself off and you have a label.
In chapter 4, you talk about that role playing, how we do it in temporary ways. I'm the person who's going to the store. I'm the customer, and there's
That's
the clerk,
another,
the person who labels himself the clerk, and I'm the customer. There's a certain defined behavior that we have.
Yes. And then when it's done collectively, the labeling, when an entire nation labels another nation in a certain way.
Yeah. Or I'm the boss, and you're the janitor.
Yes.
Or you're my subordinate.
Yes. All these are forms of mental labeling.
Mm-hmm.
So. Any kind of mental label that you are completely identified with desensitizes you to the humanity of the other human being.
Okay.
And then all kinds of things are possible. Even violence becomes possible.
Okay, I got it. Everybody, I just got this. You got this. Remember 2 weeks ago, we were talking about walking under the trees, feeling nature, not labeling the flowers, being able to experience the essence of the flowers. What you're saying here is you're labeling people as he's a jerk or he's a whatever. Once you start doing that, you become desensitized to who they really are in the same way that you were when you were labeling things in nature.
Yes.
Okay.
Right, exactly.
Okay, we have Bill. Hello, Bill. Talked to you earlier today.
Oprah, how are you?
Hi, Bill's in Connecticut on Skype. Bill and I Skyped on the Oprah Show earlier today. What's your question to us now?
Yeah, well, first of all, Eckhart, I'd like to say that this book is indicative to the quintessential essence of life. This is incredible reading. I have a very simple question. Do you compare the egoic mind to the subconscious?
I don't use those terms, but because they're a completely different frame of reference. There is, of course, a lot of subconscious activity in the egoic mind also.
Do they run in conjunction with each other, or are they separate?
Essentially, for the ego to survive, for the ego to thrive, you need to be unconscious of it. So the way I see it, I would describe the entire egoic functioning as part of the unconsciousness. And it's only when you become aware of those patterns that operate in your own mind that you are stepping out of the unconsciousness. And this is why we call it awakening. And when you suddenly become aware, even of initially perhaps, of just a tiny pattern in your mind, for example, we talked about complaining. If you become aware that often during the day you complain uselessly because it serves no purpose about other people or situations, and suddenly say, oh, there's the complaining voice in my head. Not only do you say there's the complaining voice, there is a deeper dimension of consciousness that has suddenly come forth from where you can be aware of that voice.
And what you're saying is we are the awareness.
That's right.
We are the awareness.
This is essentially who you are. You are not all those things that the awareness can be conscious of, the labels or whatever. You are the consciousness or the awareness
itself. You are
itself.
The awareness.
And as long as you don't know that...
Isn't that blow your mind, Bill?
I'm washed away here.
What is so fascinating, I was sharing this with Eckhart as we were preparing for tonight's lesson, that I received an email from you through our message boards where you were talking about how your life was sort of spiraling downhill, you were not communicating with your wife, you were sort of...
I wasn't communicating with anybody. I was stagnating. And I needed a wake-up call, and I was on the search. And when I heard you mention this book, it was the name that stuck, A New Earth. You know, that's really cool. I really have to check that out. Mm-hmm. And it took me 5 weeks to buy the book, but, you know, it's my manual for life. It's an incredible composition. It truly is.
So you were saying on the Oprah Show earlier today, many people are joining us this evening who weren't a part of the Oprah Show, but you were saying on the Oprah Show earlier today when we were Skyping that you sat down, you were going to give it a couple of hours and then...
Yeah. I figured, you know, I'll knock off two or three chapters. I got so consumed in this whole wave of writing. I was like, wow, I can't put it down. And then, you know, 12 hours later, I closed the cover and I went, wow, what an incredible ride.
Okay, and what was the biggest realization? Hey, Bill, what was the biggest realization for you?
The biggest realization, you know, the whole book itself was a realization. I didn't have any one chapter or any one paragraph. I went through, it really started on chapter 3 for me. From chapter 3, it went to the next chapter, the chapter after that, how we're brought up, how we live in a dysfunctional life. And Oprah, let me tell you something. I grew up in one of the most dysfunctional families you'd ever want to know. And this is something that we carry with us.
Your pain
and
body.
I've said that, you know, this is a manual for life. We're thrown out there. We're not given, you know, we get a manual for our cars, our appliances, our electronics, but we're thrown out there. And, you know, as young adults, it's like, go do your thing. But while we're doing our thing, we're consumed in all of the negativity that is in society, the negativity that's in our families. And it's, you know, we can take ourselves so far, but this book can take us a whole lot farther.
Well, thank you, Bill. Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm glad you were around when I was talking about the
book. I got to tell you something. I don't know where you came from, and I did read in the book that you were studying you never said what kind of a career you were on in the book. You just said that you were studying for a lucrative career, and you got off the beaten path and went into the spiritual realm. I've got to tell you something, my friend. We need more people like you.
Well, Bill, I thank you very much for that. Thank you so much. Thank you. Where were you? What were you doing? That's a good point that Bill brings up. What were you doing before? The last week you said that your thing was you never thought you were so cute.
No,
But you thought that you had such a great intellectual mind.
Yes,
so what were you doing?
I was an intellectual. I got into university fairly late because I left school at 13 or 14. And then later, when I was 18, I went to live in England, and then suddenly became interested in intellectual things. I was searching. I was becoming already more and more unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought all the answers would be found on the intellectual level.
So what were you planning on doing? Not being a spiritual teacher, obviously.
No, becoming a professor, and then have all the answers to life. And then after a while, I realized they don't have the answers.
Wow.
And I became more and more depressed and unhappy, and then suddenly something snapped inside, and this disidentification from my mind happened.
Yes.
Which happened to our friend...
Bill.
Bill, while he was reading the book, because when somebody reads the book and has such a powerful response to it, that means the reading of the book coincides with his own awakening as he reads. But this happens because he was so ready for it.
Because he was ready for it.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to see when that happens.
When that happens. But, okay, we were talking earlier about the ego loves complaining. First of all, loves to believe, loves to identify with the thoughts in the head and believe those thoughts, and loves to complain. But aren't there some things legitimately worth complaining about? You know, anybody who's ever gone into a house construction at some point or another is told a story by the construction workers, unless you have the most amazing, you know, that this is going to be finished at a certain time or it's going to be a certain price, and then it often doesn't turn out to be what you expected. That's a complaint a lot of people have.
Yes.
Isn't that legitimate?
Yes.
Like you talk in the book about, my soup is cold.
Yes, in a restaurant.
Yeah, in a restaurant. My soup is cold. Sometimes your soup is cold.
That's right.
Yes.
So first of all, the complaining that we are talking about mainly here, the egoic complaining, most of that fulfills no real purpose because it's not meant to bring about change in any situation.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, that's so, complaining and resentment complaining.
Yes, and a lot of it for many people happens only in their head. Sometimes they verbalize it also. But a lot of the complaining happens in the head alone. But no matter whether they verbalize it or whether the complaining happens in the head alone, in probably 90% of the cases, it has no real purpose because it's not meant to bring about change.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to strengthen the ego.
I see that.
As there are situations, of course, where something needs to be said in order to bring about change in the situation. And that's a completely different kind of complaining, where you say something so that change can happen. For example, the cold soup in the restaurant. You say, the soup is cold, please bring me hot soup.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. You could call that also complaining, and there are also two ways of, as far as this kind of complaining is concerned, it is connected to a real situation and is meant to bring about change.
Mm-hmm.
There's one way of complaining with ego in that situation also. And that is when the ego is attempting to make somebody wrong. A personal element comes into it, and it's a negativity that flows into it.
To make somebody wrong because my soup is cold.
Yes.
Damn it.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're personalizing it,
mm-hmm.
and so you're making another person, almost one could say, into an enemy when you complain in that way. So whether it's somebody who is a builder who is working on your home, there is a way of complaining. I wouldn't even perhaps call it complaining, of simply stating what the situation
is. Stating the facts.
Yes, without the negativity that flows into it when the ego does it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can be practiced. And it's the whatever you are stating in order to bring about change is actually going to be much more effective if it's done without the negativity. Because if it comes with negativity, it provokes a negative reaction in the other. And so the whole situation then becomes a conflict situation.
As you say, see if you can catch, that is to say, notice the voice in the head. Perhaps, I'm on page 64, everybody, second paragraph. Perhaps in the very moment it complains about something, recognize it for what it is, the voice of the ego. And then later you say, the moment you become aware of the ego in you, this is mid-paragraph, it's strictly speaking no longer the ego, but just an old conditioned mind pattern.
Yes, because ego means you're not aware of it. So ego means unconsciousness. So a good thing that people can ask themselves when they become aware of this complaining voice in the head or the verbalized complaining voice, is this meant to bring about change in the situation? And if they look at it clearly, often they will say no.
No, it's just hearing myself complain.
Yes.
Because it keeps fueling my sense of righteousness.
Yes.
And rightness.
And what the complaining voice also loves is to get confirmation from somebody else that, yes, you're right to complain. So then two people join.
Oh, yeah. And then you just fuel it on and on. Love it.
That's right.
Doris is Skyping us from outside of London. England. Doris, what's your question? Hello.
Hi, Oprah. Hi, Eckhart.
Hello.
What an amazing day or evening. The book resonated very deeply within me, I must say. And reading the on page 62, the first paragraph, resentment is the emotion that goes with complaining. It started a question within me, and I thought, like, but where do hurt feelings belong to? Is this something that my ego tells me to feel, or where do they come from, Eckhart?
Can you give a situation, an actual situation? It's always easier to talk about this when you can look at an actual situation where, for example, you experience
hurt feelings, you know, can have, most of the time, is some outside. Either way, somebody is telling you something that hurts you personally,
okay.
But what about sadness? You know, you lose a person, or, you know, hurt feelings come from many different sources. Where do they come from?
Yes.
How do they relate to the ego?
Thank you. Okay.
Okay.
So often it happens that even, let's say, somebody criticizes you and you feel hurt because perhaps you were attached to what you were doing and you feel hurt. Now, what is it in you that feels hurt? And yes, it is the ego that feels hurt. And so when that happens, all you do is, first of all, you can't say, oh, I shouldn't be feeling hurt and I shouldn't have an ego. It doesn't work. You simply accept that this is what you are feeling right now, and you recognize what it is in you that is producing
the feeling. Okay, just take it in.
It's a mental image of yourself that has become hurt. Because most people think of themselves as good people, and if somebody says you're no good, immediately something feels, and many people get extremely angry. They're not only hurt. For many people, that immediately turns into anger. And so the ego wants to immediately defend itself, even driving in traffic.
Right.
Often, let's say you're driving and another driver suddenly calls you idiot. That hurts. On one level, it hurts. It hurts the ego. And usually, immediately, the ego goes into self-repair mode, as I call it, and will shout something back in order to repair itself. But
I'm laughing at you because, I mean, I'm thinking, you know, if somebody calls me an idiot, somebody gave me the finger once, and I was like, gee, you gave me the finger. But I don't think I don't remember being hurt about it. I was so stunned by it. But yeah.
Other, many people would be hurt.
Yeah.
But you were not because you were.
I thought, what a bad day he's having.
Yes, you were in touch with a deeper level of yourself where nothing is hurt.
Yeah.
Where you can't be hurt on that.
Or when I used to take taxis all the time, when I'd have a taxi driver in a really bad mood, the worse if he was in a horrible mood, I would tip him double extra. So that it'd be nicer for the next person. Really?
That's a good one.
there's a story about an official in Japan, a high government official, went to see a Zen master, and he asked the Zen master, can you explain to me what the self is? Self really means ego. because there's talk about the self in Buddhism. Can you explain to me what the self is? And the Zen master said, what a stupid question is that? Why are you asking such stupid questions? And immediately the government official said, how dare you talk to me like that? Don't you know who I am? And the master said, that's the ego.
That's the ego. Yeah. All right, got it.
Now, this person got hurt, but in him, immediately the hurt turned into anger.
So anytime you have hurt feelings, that is your ego?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you say here, Doris, on page 65, he says, a long-standing resentment is called a grievance. To carry a grievance is to be in a permanent state of against, and that is why grievances constitute a significant part of many people's ego. Collective grievances can survive for centuries in the psyche of a nation, we know that, or tribe, and fuel a never-ending cycle of violence. And so I guess all of us need to ask, what are the grievances that we allow ourselves to carry?
Yes.
Yeah. Family grievances.
Families.
That carry on and you don't even, you forget why you're carrying the grievance.
Yes. Yes. Personal grievances, family grievances, grievances between tribes, religious groups, nations, and so on. Dreadful.
And so are you saying no grievance has a justification, that all grievances are based as the core of the ego?
It's an essential part of the ego to hold grievances. The ego keeps itself alive. That's one of the ways in which the ego keeps itself alive.
You also say on page 66 here, Doris, don't try to let go of the grievance. Trying to let go to forgive does not work. Forgiveness happens naturally when you see that it has no purpose other than to strengthen a false sense of yourself. Forgiveness happens when you realize that being resentful is only to build up your ego, that resentment is only helping you carry around this false sense of who you are.
Yes.
I got that. Yes. I got that. You got that, Doris?
Yes, I got it, too. Yes, thank you very much.
You got it, too. Good. All the way in London. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All the way over here. Thank you.
We have Tim, a retired Air Force officer who lives in Sicily, on the line. Hi, Tim. Your question?
Hello, Oprah. How you doing?
Good. Good to talk to you.
Hey, good to talk to you. Thank you for this opportunity. It's a real honor to be talking to you and Eckhart.
Okay. Your question.
I want to put this in context first. I'm jumping ahead to page 74, where Eckhart mentions that sometimes you need to protect yourself against the deeply unconscious. So in that context, my question is, in the case of war, if I protect myself and others via violence, I seem to be part of the insanity that he talks about. But to surrender our lives to, you know, any unconscious mass of people seems to push us closer to extinction. I guess my question is, are my defensive actions bringing humankind closer to or further away from a collective enlightenment? And then as a follow-up, I would just ask, is it possible, personally, can I fight a war and stay in the present, you know, keep that space between my ego and my true self?
Ooh, those are brilliant questions. Thoughtful.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
I have personally known people and read accounts of people who actually experienced an awakening in the midst of the turmoil of a war situation. When death was imminent, could happen at any second, and something within them suddenly disidentified. The ego broke down in the midst of the suffering generated by that situation. The ego collapsed, as it also has happened to people even in concentration camps and prison camps.
Mm-hmm.
I regularly get letters from people in prison who tell me that they have suddenly become free. They're still in prison, but they consider themselves free.
Yeah.
So we are talking perhaps here not only about war, but any kind of situation that usually would be described as extremely negative and unconscious. And is it possible to awaken there? Yes, it happens. I say that every human being has a spiritual teacher. For most humans, their spiritual teacher is their suffering. And a war situation is an extreme form of suffering. And ultimately, whatever happens here will lead us to awakening, even something that looks on the surface very negative, like a war situation. Eventually, even that will lead us into an awakening. And it's already happening. So yes, it is possible in the midst of war to suddenly awaken. What will happen then, I cannot foretell. It depends on whatever the situation is. It is also true to say that once you have awakened, it is very unlikely that you will still become part of violence. I'm not saying it could not happen, nothing can be said categorically, but you no longer resonate with violence. Now, so that if war will no longer happen when a certain number of people have, I don't know what the critical mass is, a certain number of people have entered the awakened state, so they no longer generate the unconsciousness, the negativity that produces war. That's
where we're evolving to.
We are evolving to
that. We haven't done so good in the 20th century nor 21st.
No, the 20th century was dreadful, the most dreadful, almost as if the ego had reached a climax there, the madness of it. And we can see a lot of that still flowing now into the 21st century also, but at the same time, something is happening in this century that is quite unprecedented. Well, it started in the later part of the last century. This awakening is quite unprecedented. If you look, for example, at previous war situations, there was very little
challenges to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was never challenged by the people.
That's right.
And now this is very different.
Right. You actually say in chapter four, you talk about how the hippie movement in the United States brought about a shift in consciousness. Yes. The movement itself started to fall apart. But the hippies actually brought a challenge to the status quo as we knew it. The hippies said...
Yes. They also, it was a disidentification from the collective image. The collective... which unto that point, people had very strongly identified with the collective.
Behaved a certain way, did things as they were told, obeyed the status quo.
Yes.
Yes. All right. You say ego takes everything personally, back to what Doris was saying earlier. Ego takes everything personally. Emotion arises, defensiveness, perhaps even aggression. Are you defending the truth? No, the truth in any case needs no defense. Yeah.
Yes. So when people argue, usually an argument, often arguments turn into violence. If people are very unconscious, and many people still are, arguments turn into violence. So when people argue about something, usually what happens is they are so identified with their opinion...
Of being right.
Yes, being right, their mental position, that any questioning of their mental position, of their opinion or their viewpoint, is regarded as an attack on them.
Yeah.
And this is how the ego gets confused with who you are.
You know, I will tell you a funny story that I was reading this book and Stedman and I were at dinner, just the two of us, talking about what are the most important questions in life. And I said one of the, I believe one of the most important questions in life is to know whether or not, it's just to know, to believe whether the universe is compassionate or not compassionate. And he said, well, I disagree with you. I think the most important thing is whether or not you know how to work on your strengths. And I go, well, that's ridiculous, because the most important thing is, do you believe that whether the universe is compassionate or not? And so we're arguing about whether or not the universe is compassionate or not compassionate. And he didn't agree with my view. And I said, well, you know I'm right. I ended up clearing the table, leaving the table, and going upstairs because I don't want to have the conversation anymore. And, you know, a half an hour passes. He comes up and he says, okay, you're right. You're right. And I go, never mind. I don't need to be right. I don't need to be right. And then I realize that, yes, that is exactly what happened.
Yes.
My ego is arguing because it is defending its right to be right.
Yes.
Yeah.
identification with a mental position, with a concept in the head.
Yes.
Can happen so easily.
Right. And we're talking about compassionate issues.
Yes.
Or non-compassionate issues.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, my friend Kidada Jones, who I was at her father's 75th birthday party the other night. Quincy Jones turned 75, everybody. And Kidada was there, his daughter. And we started talking about a new Earth, and she had so many questions that I said, Kidada, why don't you just Skype us on Monday? And here you are. Hello, Kidada.
Hi, Eckhart. Hi, Oprah. How are you?
Hi. And your question?
Okay, my question is, this book hits me really, really deep in my heart, and I know it to be the truth, but I have such resistance, and I feel like if everything in form is an illusion, it feels really disenchanting. And I'm at a point in my life where I have goals, I'm excited about my career, I want to have kids, I want to meet a great partner. And if it's all illusion, where's the fun? Not my ego.
You're not meant to believe that all is illusion. You're at a stage in your life where you can simply enjoy the play of form. Eventually, you will come to a point, as every human does, where the forms in your life are no longer completely satisfying. They leave a certain emptiness, they leave a frustration, but you haven't reached that point yet, that's fine. In the meantime, you enjoy your life, be as present as you can, which means don't project yourself continuously into some future moment that promises you more and greater fulfillment. But if that happens, and if you can't help it, that's mm-hmm. fine too. Mm-hmm. But why not enjoy this moment as it is, really? Mm-hmm. That's all you can do. This is not to take the joy out of life, it's to really deepen the way in which you live, rather than living on the surface of things and expecting fulfillment through relatively superficial things,
mm-hmm.
going deeper to a place where true joy resides.
I know, I think that's a good question, though, that you raise, Kidada, especially, I've heard this from a lot of people your age who say, so now where's ambition? Ambition, is ambition my ego? Good question.
You want to hit career strides, you want to see things happen, you're excited to meet somebody, you're going to have a baby that you're going to be madly in love with, and then I hear Eckhart's voice, and I have to remember my ego, remember that it's form, and it just kind of makes me feel a little unexcited. But I guess it's about being in the moment, so.
No, there comes a point when you can see the truth of this very clearly in your own life.
Uh-huh.
Until you can see the truth of it very clearly in your own life, the book remains on the conceptual level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't say that there's anything in the book that you should believe in.
Mm-hmm.
If the book works for you, the truth of it is immediately recognized, like in Build,
mm-hmm.
we talked to earlier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The truth of it is immediately recognized, and there's a sense of, yes. But at 20, I would not have understood the truth in this book. I had ambitions. I wanted to become a great professor. I wanted to be seen as to be successful. I wanted to show to the world that I can make it. So I was working hard. If at that point I had read this book, I would have said the same as you. I don't want this right now. I don't need this.
Mm-hmm.
The book really, as long as you feel that you don't really need it, it's fine. You should carry on with what you're doing.
I don't even hear her saying she doesn't need it. I
totally need it. I totally know that this book is real and true. And I'm actually turning 34 in a week. So it's really, really, really important for me to figure out how to integrate consciousness into this next chapter. I want to approach it in a very conscious way. But there's still probably a little part of me, a lot of part of me, that's gripping on to the form. I live in Los Angeles. I'm in a business where form is at the forefront. It's kind of a hard balance. I'm just wondering, how do you reap the fruits and not identify to the form?
Yes, forms, you can enjoy the forms, and you can really only truly enjoy the forms if you're not completely identified with the forms.
Good.
Because if you're completely identified with the forms, there's always an element of fear that the form might leave you,
mm-hmm.
the situation that you have, whatever, the form might leave you, or it will suddenly, the form will no longer be satisfying. So it's the attachment to the form doesn't really mean that you enjoy it. The attachment to the form produces negativity and produces fear around it, around your life situation.
It's doing, Kadada, what I said, I think, on an earlier class. It's like, especially in Los Angeles, you know, great fun city, city of the angels there. It's like being able to be in the world but not of it.
Yes, yes.
In the world but not of it.
Yes, and a lot of that, the attachment is less likely to be there. The more present you are with any life experience, the more present you are in the moment, then you're not attached. The attachment needs future, needs more, looks to the future, is either as a threat or hope. So be as present as you can in every situation in your life, in every moment in your life.
Yeah. And what you were talking about, I think, in one of the future chapters about being able to be present with your children instead yes. of just sort of going through the motions with your children,
yes.
being present with your children. Hey, Kadada, great to see you on Skype.
Thank you for having me.
Okay.
Bye.
Let's go to our study group who's watching our webcast at Borders on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I hear Jamie is there and has a question.
Yes. Hi, Oprah. Hi, Eckhart.
Hi.
My name is Jamie. My question is, on page 83, you mention how fame especially is such a downfall for the ego. And I'm just wondering, Oprah, how you manage to keep everything so grounded.
Oh,
I've been meaning to ask you that, too.
Really? Oh, thanks for bringing that up, Jamie. how do I manage to keep everything so grounded? I can think, I believe that I'm not attached to the fame. I don't know that to be true since I have been, quote, famous for most of my adult life. But I believe that I really am, that what I do comes from such I consider myself blessed. And I'm blessed because I have acquired fame and attention and money by being myself.
That's it. You don't play roles.
Yeah, it's not, I don't have to be anybody other than myself, and so...
And that's very rare. On television, almost everybody's playing a role.
Right.
And your success is due to the fact that you are yourself.
Right.
You're the same person outside television as you are here in the studio. So, and really, that can apply to anybody. The more you're truly yourself and not playing roles, the more powerful you are. The ego tells you need to play some role, but your true power lies in not playing a role.
I will say this, when I first started television, I was a news reporter and never was satisfied. I always felt that I was exploiting people. My whole day was based around finding the worst story possible to report. And also, I was an anchor woman, and something would happen Jamie, when the light would come on, like on this camera, there's a little red light on, and all of a sudden I'd be like talking like I am now, and the light would come on, and I would suddenly go into my newswoman anchor voice and play the role of the newswoman anchor person that I thought I was supposed to be. And one night I was reading some copy that I hadn't pre-read, and I was naming a lot of countries, and Canada was in on the list, and I called Canada, Kanada, and I started... cracking myself up that I said, did I just call Canada Kanada? And that was the breakthrough moment for me on television. That was the breakthrough moment where I was able for just a few seconds break through the wall of my facade as an anchor woman who knows all of the different countries and in Kanada. And that moment was such a funny moment for me. I couldn't stop laughing. And started the process of me being able to be myself on the air, that first little glimpse of it. So, did you have a question for Eckhart?
With all, you know, this webcast and being on Oprah, obviously you've come into incredible fame, and I didn't ask you the question because this has been what you've been preaching since you wrote The Power of Now, but do you anticipate, are you just completely self-actualized, you don't expect this to be a problem, or... How do you expect fame to come in into play for you at all now?
Yeah. No, this is so funny. Amy Gross, who's the editor of O Magazine, who's also a pretty centered person, we were talking about, Eckhart did an article for us from a conversation that we had earlier in O Magazine in our May issue. And so we were talking about Eckhart coming for the first session a couple weeks ago. She says, won't we all be surprised if Eckhart comes in a fur hat and 3 pounds of bling, wearing sunglasses with an entourage? If Eckhart walks in and go, yo, what's up? No, I don't think it's affected him, because this is so funny. When I first called Eckhart months, I don't even know how long ago it was, to tell Eckhart that I was going to be choosing A New Earth as our book club selection. I think it's our 61st selection or whatever. He was so calm about it. Later, one of the producers says, well, did you call him? Did you call him? And I said, yeah, I called him. And she said, well, was he excited? And I said, I think for him that was excitement. As I said, I'm choosing the book. He goes, yes. Very good. So anyway, I don't think it's gone to his head yet. And listen, so far, no bling.
when it happens, then you'll know the ego has come back.
I'll know the,
let me know.
I will.
Because I won't know it if it's come back.
When Eckhart comes in wearing 2 earrings, I'll let you know. Okay. Let's see. Thank you so much, Jamie. And all the group from Borders, thank you for being there every week. Yay, Borders! Michigan Avenue! Let's see some of the email questions you've been sending during our class on our computer screen here. This is Melissa from Crab Orchard, West Virginia. She says she's being awakened with worry. My sister's addicted to drugs. She's been through rehab to no avail. Every day we worry about her. We fear she may die if she continues. My question is this: how can we live awakened with this major, major distraction in our lives? That's good.
Well, the first thing, you need to take responsibility for your own life and your own state of consciousness, mm-hmm. rather than thinking your primary responsibility is your sister's life and your sister's state of consciousness. That's not the case. You have to start with yourself. Change can only begin with yourself. Mm-hmm. So are you taking responsibility for your own state of consciousness rather than or believing unconsciously that, of course, you're worried and there's nothing else you can do? You have to look at what you call the worry in yourself, the continuous mind activity that dwells on negativity. See if you can enter that state of acceptance or presence and just be with yourself. I recommend to get out of the mind, go into the body several times a day and connect with the feeling of aliveness within.
For yourself.
So that the worry pretends, worry is part of the ego, it's the compulsion to think mm-hmm. incessantly, and it serves no purpose because it doesn't get you anywhere. It's similar to the complaining, it has no useful purpose. It doesn't bring about change in any situation, no matter how much you worry, it's never the worry that brings about any change in the situation. The mind may tell you need to worry because it has some purpose. It doesn't. So the essential thing is that you get out of that unconscious habit of continuous worrying. So find a little bit of peace in yourself first to start with. And it may be more than a little bit of peace, but start with a little. Okay, is there any peace in you underneath this continuous mental noise that we call worry? Mm-hmm. Is there anything else in you? And you have to find that. You can only be of true service to your sister, you can only be of truly be an agent for change in this world if something has changed in your state of consciousness. Otherwise, you contribute to the turmoil. So find, through meditating, through bringing awareness to the present moment as much as possible, through bringing awareness into the inner body, as much as possible, get out of the mind and enter presence. And realize the mind may tell you you're not helping your sister. This is the beginning where you may be able to truly be of help to somebody else.
Because the only thing you can do is really help yourself.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
But the mind tells you, I have to save my sister.
Yes. And that's the...
And what you're saying is that is not necessarily true.
No. Ultimately, your sister is also responsible. It right. doesn't mean that one human being cannot help another, but what is essential in when we ask whether you can be of help or not to another human being is there something in you that can bring about change in the consciousness of another human being? Mm-hmm. Unless some change has happened inside you, it can't happen. But this may talk more generally about worry. This is the problem for many, many people. They wake up in the middle of the night worrying. During the day, they go about worrying about this or that. What does it mean to worry? What does it mean? It means there is unconscious mind movement projecting itself, usually, into mm-hmm. a future, and you see how dreadful the future is going to be, what's going to happen. You see outcomes that are negative. Many things, of course, are never going to happen, but worry pretends to be necessary. You have to see very clearly...
Worry pretends to be necessary. Oh, I
but
got that.
You have to see that it serves no useful purpose.
Yeah. Worry pretends to be necessary,
yes.
but serves no useful purpose.
And so once you see that it serves no useful purpose, you can sometimes maybe able to step out of that and see, oh, and then become present.
Yeah. You can become present. If you can step out of the worry for a moment, you can become present enough to say, what can I do now?
Yes.
How can I be now yes. in this moment?
Yes.
For myself, for my sister, for whatever it is you need.
Yes. Okay. And the greatest gift you can give to somebody, especially somebody who is suffering, like your sister, when you are with them, what is your state of consciousness? Are you able to bring presence when you connect with your sister or any other human being that you want to help? Can you be present with them? Can you give them space to be? That's the healing. Healing, healing. You can be an agent for healing of another, not in the sense that I am going to heal you, not believing
right.
that would be ego again. It's a, I'm going to heal you. No, simply be there as a conscious space of presence, not wanting to do anything, just being there as a conscious presence with another person.
That's very hard for people.
Yes.
I understand it's very hard for
people.
And
that's why we call it it's a shift from a...
It's a shift.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I recognize how hard it is. I'm reading this book now that from a guest is coming on the show called Beautiful Boy. You might have heard of it. It's the story of the father. The father and the son both wrote a book together. It's going to be on the Oprah Show later, and his son was an addict for many years. And very difficult for parents, especially, and as in this case, Melissa, a sister to a drug addict, to stand by and watch somebody daily... Yeah, attempt to kill themselves through
yes.
drugs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So, but acceptance is also an important part
right.
of that. It's at the moment you need to accept.
Stop
that
resisting it.
Yes.
Stop resisting.
Not bringing the resistance always into the relationship.
Because whatever you fight, you strengthen, and what you resist persists.
Yes.
That's at the top of page 75.
Yes.
Whatever you fight, you strengthen, and what you resist persists. Why is that?
Because. That's how by opposing, you bring, this world works in terms of polarities. So if you strengthen one polarity, you immediately strengthen the other. That's an example.
Physics.
Physics, mm-hmm. yes. Exactly the same.
It's physics.
Yes.
Okay. You say, because these days you frequently hear the expression, the war against this or that, and whenever you hear that, you know that it's condemned to failure. There's the war against drugs, against crime, the war against terrorism, against cancer, against poverty, and so on. And despite the war against all of these things, everything, every one of those things is bigger than ever.
That's right. Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
Because what you fight, you strengthen, and what you resist persists.
Yes. And then the implication, of course, is there is another way of dealing with things, with situations.
And that is to
life.
Make peace with it.
Make peace with it. And then take action, the action then comes out of a different state of consciousness.
The action comes out of presence.
Presence. It's no longer a reaction.
Yeah, it comes out of presence and not out of you being defensive about it.
That's right.
I got it.
And the action is much more powerful and effective when it's not defensive and not negative.
We have Dana from Monrovia, Liberia.
Oh.
on the phone. Hello?
Hello, Oprah. Hello, Eckhart.
Hello.
It's Donna.
Hi.
It's Donna. Hi, Donna.
How are you?
Oh, yes. We're happy to talk to Monrovia. Hello.
Oh, thank you.
Your question.
Shall I go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead.
My question, thank you. My question has to do with non-reaction in relationships. Would it be the same to say that the opposite of love is not hate, but rather indifference, considering if one makes that situation not a personal one?
Okay, that's your question.
Yes, I don't fully understand the question.
Don't leave, Donna.
Reading.
Go ahead.
Concerning non-reaction.
Yes.
Would it be the same to say that the opposite of love is not hate, but rather indifference?
And now, do you mean that non-reaction is indifference?
Correct. That's what I'm asking.
Oh, okay.
Particularly if one doesn't take it in a negative context.
Okay. I'm not sure.
Meaning not letting negative consume one's person.
Okay.
Well, non-reaction means that you recognize when another human being displays some form of ego behavior,
mm-hmm.
wants to be right or wants you to be wrong or accuses you of this or that, whatever, many kinds, the ego manifests in many different ways. You recognize that is its ego and you don't react to it, which means you don't confuse this behavior with who that human being is. It means you allow the ego to be there without fighting that behavior. For example, it happened some years ago, but it's an interesting example. I had a plumber come in to do some repair at my place. And he was extremely aggressive mm-hmm. And rude.
The plumber.
And I treated him as if he were a noble guest, very polite, and said, explained what needed to be done, because I recognized that perhaps he had been trapped in this pattern for years. Maybe it started with childhood when everybody around him was rude to him. So there was a deep-seated pattern of rudeness and unpleasant behavior and of regarding other people as enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't react because I recognized that as a dysfunction in him
mm-hmm.
that wasn't him at all. So I simply accepted his behavior and pointed out this needs to be done and this. After 20 minutes, he was changed completely. He was suddenly said, oh, thank you. For the first time, perhaps.
Somebody was nice to him.
Somebody was nice because everybody else reacted to him in the same way that mm-hmm. he acted.
Mm-hmm.
He got the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how most human beings encounter their daily reality.
It's the cab driver situation.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for most people, their daily reality is really a reflection of their own inner, predominant inner state.
And so the enlightened part of ourselves, after reading this book, being awakened, we realize what you're saying here in chapter 3, Core of the Ego. You should be able to recognize the ego not only in yourself, but see it in other people.
Other people.
So when you see that kind of reaction from someone, you realize it's their ego.
Yes.
It's not them.
That's right. So one could almost say it's like an illness. It's like a mental.
So the presence in you then gets to respond to, relate to the presence in them.
Yes.
You got to be really highly evolved to do that.
It's not indifference, by the way. This is not indifference.
No, that's different.
You're not indifferent.
That's compassionate.
Compassion.
Yeah.
Yes.
Understood.
Yes.
Understood.
So, understood.
In fact,
thank you for that clarity.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now,
Thank you, Donna.
Now, the question is, you say you need to be highly evolved. Well,
yes, because most people just react.
It is true to say that at first it's the reaction is so automatic when somebody behaves unconsciously to react in the same way. It's very automatic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as people begin to become more aware of their egos, usually after it's happened, they become aware that they reacted in the old ego way after the event. Then, after a while, in the middle of reacting to somebody's ego, you suddenly become aware that that's what you're doing.
Somebody just told me this last night, and this happens a lot, you know, with the airlines, where, you know, my goodness, yes. if you can get from point A to point B on commercial airlines these days without losing your luggage or flights being canceled or sitting on the tarmac or whatever, and they were reading the book, and in the midst of, you know, everything, you know, schedule for the flight, and I'm sure this has happened to many of you, schedule for the flight, everything's fine, you get there, and there's no seat. And other people didn't have their seats, and people around them were just imploding, and this person said that they decided to remain calm, as my godson, as a matter of fact, and people all around them were going nuts. And suddenly, out of nowhere, after about a half an hour, not out of nowhere, about a half an hour, the person behind the counter called the names, and of all the names to call, they called his, who had been sitting there calm. Now, they didn't know him from anybody else, but, you know, it eventually worked out. Not saying that it always works out, but he realized after reading the book that makes no sense to get crazy.
Yes, it's not only that, but also it's true that things are much more likely to work out when you are in a harmonious state of consciousness and not in resistance.
Which brings us to page 77. Do you want peace or drama?
Yes.
You say, we all want peace. There's no one who doesn't want peace, yet there's something else in you that wants the drama, wants the conflict. And whenever you're moving in the drama, you can, as we all can, I think now, a little bit anyway, detach from the thought, see yourself having the thought, recognize that you, the I of I am, is the awareness that you're having the thought. When you can see all the drama, just detach a little bit, you've done what?
That's the vital thing. See, to see it in the midst of it, to suddenly become aware that this is an old pattern in you,
yeah.
an ego pattern in
right.
you. It may not even stop immediately, but at least there is a witnessing presence in the background.
Yeah. That the ego wants to complain, the ego wants to be resentful, the ego wants drama.
Yes. And to see that in oneself, one could call that almost, there is in humans something that we could call the addiction to unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
When you are unhappy for whatever reason, once you are trapped in that energy of unhappiness, you don't want to get out.
That's right, because your ego loves it.
Yes. So there is an addiction to the, you actually, on some level, you enjoy your unhappiness, and when you can become aware of that, mm-hmm. then suddenly you're stepping out.
So let's talk about the power of awareness you talk about on page 78. A power comes into your life that is far greater than the ego, greater than the mind. All that is required to become free of the ego is to be aware of it, since awareness and ego are incompatible. This is page 78, first paragraph. Awareness is the power that is concealed within the present moment. This is why we may also call it presence. And the ultimate purpose of human existence, which is to say your purpose, is to bring that power or that presence into this world.
Yes.
That is why we're here.
Yes. That is the universal, the impulse, the universal impulse is the evolution of consciousness. That is the impulse behind the universe. The universe is moving towards the evolution of consciousness. And we are one manifestation of the evolution of consciousness into this world.
We're one.
Yes, there are many others.
Right.
Even a plant is a manifestation
right,
of that already.
Right, right. But our ultimate purpose of human existence is to bring that presence, that awareness, into the world, and to become more aware in our daily lives so that, regardless of what you're doing in your form world, in your form life, that you recognize, as you say on page 79, can I sense my essential beingness, the I am, in the background of my life at all times?
Yes.
To be more accurate, can I sense the I am that I am at this moment?
Yes. And an easy step towards that is the inner acceptance of this moment as it is, mm-hmm. without wanting it to be different or rejecting it or resisting it. If you can accept, if you can see that the primary thing in your life is the present moment, because there's never anything else.
Yes.
It's always now. So you must see if you can have a good relationship with the now, because you don't. If you don't have a good relationship with the now, you don't have a good relationship with life, because life is now.
Yes.
So accepting this moment as it is can connect you with that dimension of depth in yourself.
And that is how we begin to quiet the ego.
Yes.
Is by being more fully present now.
That's the exit out of the ego, the now.
Yeah.
The now is the hidden exit, because the ego doesn't want you to know that there is an exit and it's called now. Mm-hmm. Exit is the door out of the ego. The now is the door.
The exit.
Yes.
The now is the exit door.
Out of the ego, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so whenever you find yourself complaining, whenever you find yourself, as we said last week, the need to feel superior, you feel superior or inferior to someone else, you know that it's your ego. Whenever you recognize that this is my ego and can bring yourself to the present moment, to what is going on now, and can see yourself doing it.
Yes.
Yeah, that is awakening.
Yes.
Okay. Ginger is a singer, songwriter, living in Berlin, and is calling us via Skype. Hello?
Hi, Akko.
Berlin, hello. Germany, hello.
Hello.
Hello, schöne Grüße aus Berlin.
I guess that meant hello, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Well, I feel like I am aware of the things that I do that are destructive, and I can't seem to stop them anyway. I feel like I label things that are bad for me, and then I resist them, like eating fried food or drinking too much or relationships. I resist them, and I feel like it causes a source of anxiety, and sometimes the huge decisions in my life come easily, but these little things, little decisions every day, they pile up and become a source of anxiety. So my question is how can we get to this inspired action and effortless doing, not only when it comes to the big decisions, but when it comes to making healthy choices in our everyday lives?
Amen. Good question. Thank you, Ginger.
Yes.
I was saying this to...
I know I'm doing it. I just do it anyway.
Yeah, I was saying, why does it have to be a struggle just to do the right thing? In terms of, you know, for me, it's food always. It's always about food.
Yes.
How can it become effortless? Isn't that your question, Ginger?
Yeah.
And are you talking about, for me, this would be about potato chips. What is this about for you?
For me, it's red wine, French fries.
Okay. A little red wine every now and then.
And a few other things, of course, too.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
So you mean when you eat French fries?
And she knows that they're not so good for her.
Okay, and then there's a voice in the head that says you shouldn't be eating them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, yeah. You are eating them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A tennis match is more like it.
A lot of eating, overeating, has a lot to do with the ego also, because the ego lives in a constant state of not enough. It always seeks something else to fill itself with, and usually it's experiences to identify with this or that.
Things.
But it's also the need for more, as I call it, that is built into the ego,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes can get transferred to the body, and then you experience it as the desire to eat much more than the body really wants. It's to take in more. So really to eat consciously really is the way out of it. For example, I would suggest that when you eat your French fries, to make a meditation out of it and eat them consciously without having a secondary entity in your head that says you shouldn't be eating them. Eat them fully and consciously, and at the same time, feel how your body feels while you eat them and after you've eaten them. Then you bring some presence into it, and you may realize in some cases that the body doesn't actually want to eat them. It was the mind that wanted to eat the potato. But so eat consciously. If you eat a sandwich, if you go to the fridge, sometimes people get up in the middle of the night, they open the door, and and you reach in, and there's this need for, the body doesn't
You're trying
eat
to
it.
Feed something.
Feed something, yes. And so...
For me, it's also, it's the anxiety that the resistance, not just for food, but things that I label as bad for me, seem to cause a lot of anxiety in the...
What he's saying is stop resisting. Actually, after reading this book, I've been trying this lately, exactly what you said. And this is what you will find. If you stop resisting it, because the French fries are not bad, it's the thought in your head that has told you that the French fries are bad. And if you do what he is recommending, if you sit and you consciously make it a meditation, what you will find is you won't eat, you know, two bags of French fries unconsciously, that you will enjoy every single French fry, and in the enjoyment and the pleasure, if you stop when it's no longer pleasurable, you know, it's no longer pleasurable after three or four or five. By the time you've eaten a whole bag of them, you don't even taste it anymore. So he's saying make it a meditation, be with it, feel it, sense it, allow your whole body to be with it, feel it, sense it, and when you're done with the pleasure of it, let it go.
Yes.
That is what you're saying, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's with the red wine, too.
Yes.
And other things as well, I suspect.
And other things as well.
When
yes.
I was in
Be
my...
with it. Be
yes.
with it.
When I was in my 20s, as young people do, I would often get drunk. Nowadays, I still enjoy a glass of wine.
Right.
I
you
enjoy
do.
It very much.
Yes.
And I know after I've had one glass of wine, sometimes. Does my body want another glass of wine? And usually I cannot drink more than one glass. It's very rare that I would drink two glasses of wine, because that's exactly, the body says no more. So you can sense your body, it will often tell you whether it's right or not to
that's
eat
right.
or drink
well,
something.
That's a very good point that you just made. I just had an epiphany. Because you don't become overweight or even drunk or intoxicated as long as you are acting consciously. It's when you become unconscious that you eat too much, unconscious that you drink too much, unconscious is when you become obsessively indulgent
yes.
with things.
Yes, all these addictions are unconscious.
Are unconscious. Ginger from Berlin, love that green you're wearing, girl. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy
Thanks for joining us.
Enjoy your fries.
Enjoy, yeah, have a glass of wine. Consciously. Page 78, everybody. Bottom paragraph. What is spiritual realization? The belief that you are spirit? You say no. That is a thought. A little closer to the truth than the thought that believes you are who your birth certificate says you are, but still a thought. So, we're not spirit? I thought we were spirit. What is that saying, that we are spiritual beings having a human experience?
Yes, that's very good. But
yes, but we're not spirit.
No, that when we say we are spiritual beings having a human experience is not yet the realization that we are, it's the belief that we are.
Oh, okay.
So there is a step that goes from the belief. Belief is still, it's a mental concept. It's a little closer, as I say, to believing that you are your what your birth certificate says you are.
Yes.
But it's not the realization. No thought that you have about yourself is realization.
Okay, well, this is another thing. You know, a lot of people are still very conflicted about this spirituality and their religion. Mm. And what I hear you saying, feel you saying in this book is that this book isn't about believing.
No.
This book is about what you come to know for yourself.
Yes.
Yeah, what you become to feel for yourself.
Yes.
And that what you're saying is that God, in the essence of all consciousness, isn't something to believe. God is.
Yes.
God is. Yes. And God is a feeling experience, not a believing experience.
That's right.
And if your religion is a believing experience, if God for you is still about a belief, then it's not truly God.
No.
That's what you're saying.
Yes.
At best,
a belief is a transitional thing, that
yes.
from there you go on to the realization. that there is no separation between you and God, between you and the source of life,
mm-hmm.
that you are one with the source. And you cannot realize that through
believing.
Thinking.
It's not a belief.
It's not a thought.
Not a thought.
It's a direct realization within yourself, and it's there in the gap between two thoughts. Suddenly.
That's right.
And conceptually, you may not know anymore. You may not have an opinion of who you are anymore. And yet, at a very deep level, there is a knowing that cannot be put into words.
So, what is spiritual realization? The belief that you are spirit? No, that's a thought. Closer to the truth than the thought that believes you are who you are, or that your birth certificate says you are, but still a thought. Spiritual realization is to see clearly. On the bottom of page 78, everybody. Spiritual realization is to see clearly that what I perceive, experience, think, or feel is ultimately not who I am. That I cannot find myself in all those things that continuously pass away.
Yes, so you are the space for all those things. You are the consciousness,
mm-hmm.
the awareness, in which all those things, experiences, sense perceptions, thoughts, mm-hmm. emotions,
mm-hmm.
come, they appear. You are, Jesus says, you are the light of the world. That means you are the consciousness in which the world appears, is seen. And the consciousness itself has no form. It is formless, and it is, has nothing to do with time. It is the dimension of the timeless in yourself. Eternity is the religious term for it.
Okay.
For most religious people, when they use eternity, it's a very abstract concept.
Right.
Eternity, what do I do with that? Or they believe it's continuous time that never ends. That would mm-hmm. be extremely boring if you were eternity and there's no end to time, would become very boring. I wouldn't want to things to go on forever, and my life to go on forever, ever, ever. But finding the timeless dimension is a very different thing in yourself.
Timelessness is very different than eternity, as you're saying.
The true meaning of eternity is timelessness.
Is timelessness.
It's usually misinterpreted as meaning endless
on
time.
On and on and on and on.
Yeah.
I got that.
So there is in every human being, underneath all the stream of thinking and underneath the emotions, there is that dimension where timelessness or eternity dwells, and that is the essence of who you are, and that is consciousness itself. And you can know it by realizing that you are the space for whatever happens in your life, space of consciousness.
Deep. I must say that's pretty deep there, Eckhart. We're on page 80, everybody. One of my favorite quotes in the entire book. That actually I had used in one of our ads in O Magazine. Only the truth of who you are, if realized, will set you free.
Yes, yes. Know who you are and you are free. But know who you are doesn't mean that suddenly you have an answer in your head. There's a stillness, and in that stillness, when you accept that you don't know who you are, as I say somewhere in the book,
mm-hmm.
when you completely accept that you've realized all the things that you thought you were is not really who you are. And then you come to a point where you don't know who you are. And if you can fully accept that you don't know who you are closer to who you are than you were ever before.
Once you realize and accept that all structures, page 81, forms are unstable, even the seemingly solid material ones, peace arises within you. This is because the recognition of the impermanence of all forms awakens you to the dimension of the formless within.
Yes.
That's what you're calling timelessness.
Yes.
That which is beyond death. Jesus called it eternal life.
Eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you believe what happens to us at death when the body dies?
You don't
have a belief.
I don't give it any thought.
You don't?
No.
Well, did you ever think about it, Eckhart?
I know that the essence of who I am, which is the essence of who you are, is indestructible. I know that directly as on a feeling level. And you can also know it even if you talk to a physicist. He will tell you that energy never gets destroyed. It can only transform.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever it is that animates this physical form at some point, whatever it is that animates this physical form is going to no longer animate this form, and that is when you see a dead body. And when you see a dead body, you see, a year and a half ago, both my parents died within a space of a few months. And I saw very clearly, each time I saw that my mother's body lying there. A few months later, I saw my father's body lying in the coffin. And I realized the form was still there, but the essence of that being was not present. So the essence of that being was never the form. It was gone. It was no longer there. And then when that which animates the form...
The essence of that being was never the form.
Was never.
The essence of that being inhabited the form.
Yes, because...
And now it no longer inhabited
yes,
the form.
So you could see there was only a shell there.
Right.
And that was... It's such a clear realization.
Yeah, many people who've seen their loved ones in the casket see that.
Yes. So that which was the life within that form was always invisible. All you could ever see was the form. Maybe you could sense the life within the form, but the life is always invisible, and the life ultimately has no form itself.
Mm.
And so you see, suddenly somebody dies, the essence is gone, the life within the form is gone.
So what you're saying, again, on page 79, is to be able to be in form and be able to sense the formlessness of yourself.
Yes.
To be in form and to sense that there is an essential beingness or formlessness, the I am in the background of our life at all times.
Yes.
And that awareness, that formlessness, is what can hear, see, sense the thoughts that are going on all the time. And there's a little space, just a space, between the thoughts and the awareness of the thoughts.
Yes.
And that is where I reside.
Yes, you are the awareness, you are consciousness, appearing as a person for a little while, but in essence, you are consciousness, and consciousness is, as consciousness, you are timeless. You are eternal in the sense of timeless.
And when the form itself is lying there in the casket, that timeless formlessness has gone where?
Transform to have either to join with the source or to go through further experiences of awakening.
Mm. In ways that our mind cannot even comprehend.
No.
Okay. Before we say goodbye, I want to thank all of you around the world for making this remarkable experience possible. Eckhart and I will be here again next Monday at 8 p.m. Central. This third class will be available on demand tomorrow for free here at Oprah.com. And if you want to download a podcast of any of our three classes, you can do that tomorrow at Oprah.com and iTunes. So what did you want to say in conclusion about the core of the ego?
The core of the ego. The ego, sometimes we look at it as if it were an entity, but really it's just a form of unconsciousness. It appears to be an entity sometimes. It is not threatening, never regarded as an enemy or something that you need to get rid of. It's only to be recognized for what it is. So, and then the ego has fulfilled its purpose. It has taken you to that point of awakening. So, in order to awaken, humans have were in the state of oneness with the source when they first came here, and then they lost themselves. They lost themselves in thinking, they lost themselves in the mind, they lost themselves in the ego. And then they reached the stage where this state of being lost produces so much suffering that this dream of life becomes a nightmare, and they start waking up in this stage that we have reached now. So as we wake up, we regain the state that we once had, we lost, the state of oneness with life, oneness
with God. So we're waking up now.
Oneness with the source. But when we regain it at a deeper level because we are conscious of it now.
Wonderful. Thank you. Can't wait till next week because, you know, this week we're talking about all the things that form the core of the ego, how the ego loves to complain and it loves to be right and it loves drama and all of that. Next week we talk about role-playing, all the many faces of the ego, how so many of us believe that we are the roles that we play. That's next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Another night. Yay. It's good. It's good.